Hey everyone, and welcome to this special feature edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This podcast is brought to you by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. The foundation funds a lot of interesting people and work in the cybersecurity space, and they're supporting this special podcast series that examines topics of interest to cyber policymakers. In this podcast, we're going to hear from Alexa O'Brien. She is currently studying a master's in applied intelligence at Georgetown University. And she's also working on an ethical framework for the applied intelligence discipline, collection, analysis, and the like, which is for media practitioners. Alexa is also a journalist. Her most recent major work is a July 2019 analysis of the US media's coverage of civilian harm in the war against ISIS. And I've linked through to that in the show notes for this episode. And before she worked as an established journalist, Alexa actually covered Chelsea Manning's trial at Fort Meade on her blog, and her transcript of those proceedings were a tremendous help to the wider media. And it was this work that, as you'll hear, briefly pulled her into the WikiLeaks scene, the WikiLeaks orbit, if you will. It wasn't a good fit. Alexa joined me for this freewheeling discussion about intelligence, ethics, moral authority, and signs that not everything is as it seems in the WikiLeaks universe. Alexa started off by telling me about how things started unfolding for her when she was covering the Manning trial at Fort Meade. Here's what she had to say.
Two foundations, the Freedom of the Press Foundation and the Institute for Media Analysis, basically started to support my work at Fort Meade. And so, you know, during the proceeding, my website became the unofficial repository of the court record. And, you know, I reconstructed the appellate list. I was doing all this kind of forensic analysis of the case. A lot of journalists relied on me because they couldn't get to Fort Meade. So it was around that time that I started getting approached by people. Like, for example, you know, Kim.com sort of hit me up.
Oh, God.
At that point and said, you know, we need an investigator. You know, we'd love to hire you. After the trial, Glenn Greenwald, you know, gave me a call and was like, we'd love to bring you on to The Intercept. Ratner set up an interview, you know, between me and Assange at that point. Mm-hmm. I had obviously spoken to, you know, WikiLeaks people over, you know, chat sort of through the proceedings, if there were questions that came up or blah, 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 blah about what was going on. So what I did is I got invited to Chaos Computer Club to give a presentation. So like late December, I went to Germany and I have family in Germany. And for 6 months, I lived in Berlin with Sarah Harrison. And I knew by June of 2014 that it just was not a good fit for me. So I came back. You know, I had been working on specifically on the Manning court record, which came out in March of 2014, and the US investigation. So I never ever dealt with anything, you know, in terms of like internal to WikiLeaks. I was just doing my research on the US investigation circa 2010 and also the Manning court record, which we finally got.
It seems to me that you're much more sort of just intellectually curious and around these concepts and around this stuff rather than wanting to be an activist per se.
Yeah, I mean, to me, obviously, like, I'm not going to say that my own cognitive biases early on didn't influence me or my own sense of, like, even patriotism. I mean, like, you know, for me, you don't cover the Manning trial if you're ambivalent about your country. I mean, for me, it's about oversight of the judiciary and making sure that because the trial involved two charges that apply to any person, not just military personnel, vis-a-vis information. I mean, these were all sort of inspiring things. But because of my analytic background in political science, and because of the way that I sort of, you know, have been educated, I don't look at those views without skepticism or without critical thinking skills. So all those things inform my judgment. I mean, even to leave in June, like I already knew the fit wasn't right because the ideology, whether it's, you know, articulated or known by the members of WikiLeaks or their crowd around them, and also their sort of philosophical understanding of their own ideas is pretty piss poor, you know?
And that's a very succinct way of describing it. But this is, I mean, this is the reason I wanted to lead with this discussion about your prior sort of involvement. I mean, to even call it an involvement is probably a bit of a stretch, but your prior sort of contact with, you know, with that scene is, at that time, I don't think it was really you know, I don't think the logical sort of conclusion or the logical extension of their philosophy at that time was necessarily on the public's radar. It probably looks a little bit more obvious now. It feels like what you're saying is that, you know, by 2014, you could, due to your proximity to the whole thing, you could sort of see that there were some issues there.
Yeah. I mean, there were, it wasn't just philosophical or value issues. It was also for me, look, I'm not a trained intelligence practitioner. Okay. But I have traveled, you know, as a young person. When you're around a particular milieu of people and RT takes a great interest in you, you know what I mean? Where they're, the minute you hit, you know, literally within weeks of hitting the ground in the US, I have, you know, Putin's people essentially offering me, you know, a news show or whatever, or, you know, Telsur hits you the minute you get to Berlin, or you just talk to people, like, just a lot of people coming around me, trying to get information from me, because this is in the height of the Snowden releases, you have to remember. Yeah. So I'm in Berlin during this period, and there's just a lot of like sketchy people sort of coming around and, you know, inviting me to dinner like four times when you know the exchange should only have lasted 10 minutes because you're not that interesting and they're not, you know what I mean? It's not that I knew certain things on a cognitive, very clear front, but I knew that there were things going on and that the people around that organization either were oblivious to it or they were too dumb. There were just things that my gut told me I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on, but I got to go because this is like above a level of water where, you know, it's not right for me. It's just not, doesn't feel comfortable.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's like, I often wonder how much people in that scene are aware of the efforts that are going on behind the scenes to sort of direct it, if that makes sense. You know, they don't even have to be knowingly doing the bidding of say, you know, state-backed services, but they could be influenced by them without even knowing. So it sort of like doesn't really matter whether they're wittingly going along with this stuff. I mean, where did you land on that, you know, on figuring that out? Do you have any feelings there?
I think you've raised like the central issue. What business does a website have soliciting classified information, you know, with a particular agenda, which has certainly morphed and become even more malevolent over time, if they don't understand counterintelligence? I mean, I'm a nobody, so to speak. You know what I mean? I'm, you know, and if I'm sensing that something's up just with common sense, you'd think that a website that's soliciting classified information would have some common sense.
You see where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually one of the last conversations that I had in person with Assange, you know, in the embassy, because I had left, but I had talked to the lawyers when I came back about, you know, this isn't working. But I got invited to this journalism conference in London in, I think it was August 2015, and I stopped by the embassy. And this is one of the things I said to him. It's like, you know, your counterintelligence, your whole, like, it's dumb. The naivete and lack of critical thinking skills, ability to make appropriate judgments, the lack of sort of solid ethical values about, you know, lines and the like, but really mostly the just uninformed and, you know, for use of a better word, stupidity of the people around that milieu, really is a cause for pause.
Yeah, you keep using the word naivete, right? But I wonder if they are genuinely naive or if they're just pretending to be naive because it gives them sort of a, you know, the appearance of a moral high ground here. You know, they can say, oh, we're just interested in the truth. We're just interested in, you know, reporting on the misdeeds of various governments and things like that. You know, well, this information didn't come from the Russian government. That's crazy. This information didn't come from anyone with an agenda. You know, that seems to be their, you know, PR defense at least.
Yeah, I think I would call it propaganda. I mean, it's straight up propaganda. And I think that they're, you know, we can't look at WikiLeaks also as a monolithic entity. There are different people. So if we're talking about the central people in WikiLeaks, which included Assange, Sarah Harrison, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, based on, you know, just what I've learned over the last couple of years, I would include people like Andy Miller-Magoon and, you know, Baron Fix and those folks. they're all different types of people, and they have different capacities, intellectual capacities. But yes, you know, you're asking a question: is it naivete? Well, that's the central question. I absolutely think it's completely legitimate to look at them as a hostile, non-state intelligence service. We don't even have to like do an abstract political analysis of it. Look at what WikiLeaks has said about itself publicly. Okay, so, you know, it's in the beginning, it was an aspirant intelligence agency for the public. That's like circa 2007. Okay, it doesn't, obviously, the organization and Assange clearly, at least publicly, don't propose to understand what an intelligence agency is, that it needs legitimate authority, where WikiLeaks gets its legitimate authority as an analytic, you know, intelligence agency or collections agency. That's the big open question, right? Where does it get its authority from? Well, it could say, well, we're an intelligence agency for the public, but we're also a media organization. You know, intelligence analysis is very different, or sorry, intelligence is different than journalism. They oftentimes are conflated, but they're different. So WikiLeaks is saying, we're an intelligence agency for the public because we collect information and our customer is the public, not a policymaker. But intelligence is used in the competition between nations. And it's even used by non-state actors. I mean, I'm not making the correlation between Al-Qaeda and WikiLeaks, but Al-Qaeda, you know, collected on the U.S. and did covert actions against the U.S. Okay, that's where you know, they, that comes
so
from that.
I guess what you're saying is, like, you know, the idea of an intelligence agency for the public is kind of like a dumb one, right? Like, that's not something
that
can exist.
Right, it's dumb. We presume it's dumb. Okay?
Because you know, you can't have an intelligence agency that lacks an agenda, I guess, is what you're getting at.
That lacks authority, like legitimate authority from the public, okay? Which is, you know, partly has oversight. You know, people might criticize congressional oversight, but we have congressional oversight of.
Well,
US
I don't know that Al-Qaeda's intelligence collection would have. You know, you could say that was backed by any authority other than the power of the people running it, right? Like, you know, I don't think there was any moral authority there. But, you know, I'm just curious if you think that, you know, having an agenda, a purpose to drive the whole thing, is what makes an intelligence agency an intelligence agency.
You have to look at intelligence is a competition between states traditionally, and it's based in just war principles. So the same sort of sensibility of just war principles, you know, proportionality, legitimate authority, all of that is the basis of silent warfare, which is intelligence. And that can include espionage, it can include covert activity, it can include just like straight up collections, okay, for the purpose of informing policymakers to make good decisions. Okay, that's the sort of like principle underneath what an intelligence agency is. But, you know, WikiLeaks has also called itself a combatant. Media organizations, if you look at just the history of people who cover warfare, you know, at kinetic warfare, like journalists on the ground in Iraq, Syria, etc., they tend to stress the civilian nature of their work. That's like priority. They don't say I'm a combatant. In fact, they say the exact opposite, because they want to have the protection that's provided to them under, you know, international law.
But I mean, they, you know, as much as they say they're combatants, they have this really nebulous definition of what the enemy is, like what they're fighting. I mean, it seems to me that they're fighting, you know, just the United States essentially, but they don't say that per se, do they?
Okay, well, basically, according to the political philosophy that's, you know, they've spoken about publicly in, you know, in Assange's writings with, you know, Applebaum, Miller Magoon, and the like, the cypherpunk, you know, sort of conversation, Assange talks about, you know, how the legitimacy of nation states have been eroded by cyberspace. And, you know, there's a kind of confusing sort of sensibility that they have about what their political philosophy is, because they tend to conflate a lot of domains. So they say they're sort of operating both in war and peace, and they're operating in a state of nature, but they have these moral rights that allow them to publish. It's all very convoluted.
Could the problem be right now that we're actually trying to assign a coherent understanding of WikiLeaks' philosophy and there just isn't one? Do they actually have a clear idea of what the hell they're doing, or are they just sort of winging it?
I think that it's coherent enough to see that it's, number one, flawed, problematic, and it needs to be like scrutinized. So number one, they claim that they are an aspirant intelligence agency for the public. Well, what's an intelligence agency, right? What's journalism? Number two, they've said that they're a combatant. That's very sort of dangerous language for a journalistic entity to say, even if they're talking within the cyber realm. You know, clearly under international law, which WikiLeaks oftentimes appeals to as the basis for its purported right to do whatever the hell it wants without any, you know, answering to any lawful authority, because no law can touch WikiLeaks, right? They're a stateless media organization. Well, that statelessness that they're talking about isn't the sort of statelessness of Reuters, right? Reuters operates across the globe. It has different jurisdictions and it tries to be impartial and independent as, you know, as an sort of a news agency. WikiLeaks is neither, you know, impartial or independent. We don't know where their funding comes from. They say things like, well, we're, you know, not for profit organization. Defense filings in the Schulte case talk about them being a not for profit. They're not a not for profit. You know, what's Sunshine Press? All the crypto sort of funding that they get, you know, where's it coming from?
Yeah.
Who are their patrons? And then you have to also talk about the exchange of value, selling intelligence for access. If you look at like Assange and his reported engagements with Ecuador or with Russia or with other state entities vis-a-vis his, you know, asylum or pardon, you know, what if any exchange is happening to affect those kinds of ends.
Now, this is an interesting thing, right? Because how on earth, you know, you sort of wonder, how did he get asylum there? Was there a bit of, you know, did he have some dirt on someone? I mean, you know, this is just pure speculation. I've not seen anything to suggest that that's the case, but you do kind of wonder, you know, if there was some shenanigans involved in him being able to stay in that embassy for such a long time, which brings me to, you know, something that I want to ask you about, which is Ola Binney. Who is Ola Binney and what is his relationship to WikiLeaks and what is the predicament he currently finds himself in?
Ola Binney is a Swedish programmer who is described publicly as an associate of Assange. He's a suspected member of WikiLeaks. He is currently about to undergo a criminal trial as a defendant in Ecuador. He was arrested right around the time the Assange indictment came out. A lot of this, you know, there's a lot of lack of clarity around his case. I mean, even EFF, who sent people to, you know, to Ecuador, who spoke Spanish to try to understand, you know, what he's been charged with and, you know, how credible those allegations are. They were concerned because he's a security professional that his use of encryption might be, you know, considered nefarious or malicious when it might not be. They themselves could not quite understand what computer systems he's been accused of hacking. At the time he was arrested, the Ecuadorian officials also said that that he had been linked to two Russian hackers. We don't know who those Russian hackers are. There's no record of their arrest.
I mean, it looks, you know, just from a cartoon-like reading of this, it looks like the guy has basically been vanned in Ecuador for reasons unknown.
Well, since we're dealing with intelligence too, and not just public information, we have to also look at it from a counterintelligence point of view. So there are clearly, you know, the U.S. has, it looks to, from based on the public record, has been investigating WikiLeaks for many years, but it really turned up a notch in 2015. They were looking into the Snowden thing before that. But the Obama administration pretty much said, okay, WikiLeaks is a media organization right after the Manning trial. So that's like, you know, 2013 period.
Can you explain just for the listeners why, you know, there would be a Snowden angle to WikiLeaks?
Well, Snowden helped, WikiLeaks helped Snowden get to Russia.
That's
true. I mean, Sarah Harrison.
No, I mean, it's just funny because listeners might think, well, that was just WikiLeaks trying to help out someone with shared values. But the view, certainly inside the US intelligence community, is a little bit different, isn't it, of that whole episode?
Based on public reporting, the view from the US intelligence community has evolved over time. As of like, you know, 2014, 2015, there was a sensibility that they didn't know exactly what had happened. I mean, I'm not privy to sort of like, you know, secret information. And secondly, if I do know things from other people's work, I'm not exactly going to spill it out on, like, you know, because it's not my right
sure.
to do that. I think that, you know, just to answer your question, like, well, why should the public be more skeptical? Because we're not just dealing with journalism or public information or data. We are dealing with a competition between states. We are dealing with the realm of intelligence as well. And in the realm of intelligence, Not everyone is who they say they are. In the realm of intelligence, people's naivete is used to actually trick them to affect another nation's agenda.
Well, and this is right? kind of what I was getting at before with, like, do the central figures in WikiLeaks kind of realize that perhaps there is a lot of effort going into manipulating them, you know, for that reason. And I think that is, it's something that I guess if you are from outside this space, you know, it sounds like really crazy paranoia. Like if I sit down and talk with my mum about it, like, oh yeah, there's probably a massive amount of work going in to trying to, you know, manipulate, surveil, and, you know, cause WikiLeaks to perform certain actions that will be favorable to country X, you know, it sounds like paranoid nut job stuff, but it is absolutely what you're going to expect, right? Like this is how it works.
That's a cognitive bias though, because for an organization like, you know, WikiLeaks, or for Julian Assange and Sarah Harrison and Andy Miller-Magoon to be paranoid about CIA surveillance.
But not paranoid CIA. About FSB or GRU or whatever, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make logical sense. And, you know, as I posted on my blog last week, Andy Miller-Magoon has said publicly, you know, in his 36C3 video, as well as to the Washington Post, that he's not a member of WikiLeaks. That's not my understanding, because I was approached by Baron Fix in April, the first week of April of 2016. This is in the run-up to the Schulte leaks. This is in the run-up to 2016 election interference. They wanted to hire me because it was claimed their submission system was full, right? So there's a lot of people even within WikiLeaks who are not saying who they are,
yeah,
right? And there's always this sort of plot. They say it's for their own security. They say it's really for plausible deniability. If you look at a media organization, you tend to know who the staff are. You tend to know what the editorial board is. You know what the process is. And it's all clearly outlined on their website. You know, the New York Times has an ethical handbook that they publish that say, this is how we deal with the news. We don't break into computer systems. We don't allow our reporters to, you know, record calls without their permission. None of that's done on the WikiLeaks website.
So this, right? What's funny about this conversation so far is, like, it doesn't really have a solid narrative arc. It's just like the shadiest of shady snippets left, right, and center, right? And that's kind of what WikiLeaks is. There is no, you know, it's a very nebulous thing, right? Like, and it doesn't have like this very straightforward arc. But just anywhere you tend to pay attention, anywhere that you tend to zoom in, it's just all pretty weird and sus, you know?
Look, I think part of the reason why there isn't a clear narrative arc is because the world has changed a lot in the last 10 years. Mm. The media environment has changed a lot. So in certain senses, we're catching up to where we are now. So that's part of the reason why there's a lack of articulation about what exactly is going on. It's part of the reason why I'm working on the masters that I'm working on, because it needs to be done. And I don't think I'm the only person that needs to do it, but that's part of that process. Number two, intelligence has changed too. Espionage has changed. It's flatter now. If you look at the way telecommunications has has transformed businesses so that they're flatter, they outsource more, you know, they're decentralized more in certain cases. Two, you see that also in organized crime. You know, if you look at, like, for example, the Russian, you know, organized crime and its relationship to the state, it's very decentralized. Part of that's built in to the fact that Russian organized crime existed also under totalitarianism, so it had to be decentralized to protect itself against authorities and the like. So look at espionage too. Espionage can be considered flatter as well in certain circumstances. I'm not saying that traditional espionage doesn't exist, where you have moles inside, right, you know, intelligence community organizations. But if you can radicalize a particular population, take Assange's own speech at Chaos Computer Club, which is available on the internet in 2013, December, where he talks about going into the CIA and taking the ball out. That's his language. And giving it to WikiLeaks. I mean, that's also, in a certain sense, radicalizing, you know, unilaterally acting and or witting and unwitting pawns of foreign intelligence services to sort of cripple the U.S. intelligence community.
Mm.
So there's all these indicators. That's what they call it in intelligence. There's indicators that provide a better perspective on how to view the organization. And the difference between journalism and intelligence is intelligence has to operate in the realm of denial and deception, right? Mm. Signaling. It has to operate in the realm of gaps in information, because obviously you're denied certain information. And you have to make an assessment. That's where that judgment comes in. You know, if WikiLeaks purports to be an aspirant intel agency for the public, they've made like horrible analytic flaws. I mean, the Seth Rich conspiracy theory,
let's not even get into that, because it's just appalling. Look, there's two more things I really, really want to talk to you about. I mean, I want to talk to you about your master's work, and I want to talk to you about Vault 7. But before we get into that, I just wanted to ask you, like, you know, an organization that seems to have radically different aims, but operates under some similar principles is Bellingcat. I just wonder if you have any feelings on Bellingcat, because they certainly do this open, they say they do open source intelligence, but quite often they're doing stuff, they're pulling torrents of leaked information, like passport information, which, you know, is available on the internet, but it is leaked information. They're kind of doing different stuff, but using some of the same techniques. Whereas, you know, the view within the IC seems to be much more positive towards Bellingcat than it is WikiLeaks. Like, how do we articulate the difference between Bellingcat and WikiLeaks?
Well, I've actually talked to Elliot at Bellingcat for my master's as well. I think Bellingcat is very different than WikiLeaks in a couple of specific ways. Let's look at, like, as an, you know, we taking the proposition of like open source intelligence agency. Let's just like try to give like both, you know, organizations like the benefit of the doubt, right? For one thing, if you look at a Bellingcat training, they actually talk about their ethics. So when they're talking to other journalists, they actually, you know, define, you know, why they decided to do certain things, you know, based on a ladder of escalation. So, for example, in the case of using that, they didn't publish the torrent of Russian state citizens' passport information, right? They use that information, and then they use traditional investigative techniques that journalists use, you know, in concert with a media organization, where they went and they corroborated the information. They didn't publish it, and they explained why they didn't publish that information, because obviously they were concerned about protecting privacy.
So the difference is they're not, you know, they've actually put some more thought into this, and it's not just, you know, they're not hiding behind that cloak of naivety. They've thought about this stuff.
It's not even just that they thought about it. They actually have principles about protecting the actual moral rights of the people that they're collecting on. So with WikiLeaks claims that it protects the privacy of the weak. You know, what is it? Privacy for the weak, you know, transparency for the powerful, right?
Yeah.
WikiLeaks is an aggressive collector. They critique the US government. They critique Facebook. They are aggressively collecting on the US intelligence community, including private citizens, via hacked information, and they are publishing it in raw form, social security numbers, you know, addresses, names, whatever. And they have no minimization. So
hang on, the difference seems to be then that Bellingcat actually exercises some editorial judgment.
Right. They actually exercise also what WikiLeaks claims to be the very foundation that justifies their existence and their ability to do what they do. There's no oversight over WikiLeaks. It doesn't have legitimate authority as an intelligence agency in the kind of competition between states. As a media organization, they are not a party to a social contract, which is what journalism is protected, because it has a social role. And for a journalist to sort of act in a manner that's destructive to society is absurd, to sort of protect that class of people.
Well, right? I mean, you know, they would argue about, you know, that notion of it being destructive to society, because everybody thinks, even people doing things that you might not agree with, I mean, generally speaking, people think they're making the world a better place, but that's, you know, that's another 20 minutes that we don't have time for right now. But I do want to ask you about the Vault 7 stuff, because this is just bonkers, right? Like, I mean, we cover snippets in the weekly news show about this guy. What's his name? Joshua Schulte. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Schulte, yeah.
So Joshua Schulte was the guy who leaked the Vault 7 material. Now, in my mind, you know, if someone leaked to me the fact that the CIA had implants that could own smart televisions and could do this and do that, that's worth reporting on. I mean, that is newsworthy, that these types of electronic techniques are being used by a very powerful intelligence agency. Where it just goes completely bonkers is where WikiLeaks actually published the tools themselves, which you know, is going to put a lot of people in danger, in my view. I don't think that was a sensible editorial judgment, but that seemed to be the whole idea behind the Vault 7 thing, was to inflict as much damage to the CIA as possible. What was, you know, from what we know, I mean, this guy seems absolutely bonkers, but what do we know about his motivations in submitting this stuff to WikiLeaks in the first place?
Well, I think you have to, before I even answer that question, I think you also, we also have to look at the Vault 7 leak and the Vault 8 leak within the context of shadow brokers and also Assange's attempt to get a pardon or, you know, immunity from the United States. So if you look at the timeline, while Assange is a sort of exerting pressure on the U.S. government, shadow brokers is happening and Schulte is happening, right? So there's that whole context too of what is what, because if you look at the shadow brokers leaks, and this is the work of Electrospaces. So Electrospaces shows that the material that the second unattributed source of NSA material that isn't Snowden was probably shared between shadow brokers and this second source. So they could share the same. And if you look at all of the second source related leaks, they all go back to WikiLeaks, meaning to say that there's some WikiLeaks person that's at Der Spiegel, or there's some WikiLeaks person that is, you know, connected to non-WikiLeaks related second source releases. So there's all that going on in the midst of the sort of context of the Schulte releases. And Empty Wheel has written about this, and I think it's a pretty solid analysis. It raises a lot of important questions about, you know, what Assange's purpose was in going to seek immunity, and how at the time the U.S. intelligence community was basically, you know, from all sides, you know, facing these massive breaches of signal intelligence collection capabilities. And this is all happening also in the run-up to 2016 election interference, where you had also, you saw this sort of back and forth between Russia and the United States about leaking material related to, you know, political corruption.
Well, I mean, you know, to me, the shadow brokers leaks really looked like a way to perhaps blunt the response from the United States to the 2016, you know, DNC stuff. Like, it very much seemed like, well, you can come after us, but we've got all your tools and we're going to see you coming. I mean, that's what it felt like to me.
And you can also look at the Schulte leaks the same way, meaning to say, like, you know, you could, one perspective, so it's an analysis, it's a judgment. You could look and say and conclude that when Assange is making his entree to the United States for immunity and pardon and the like, he's also basically has the hammer of the CIA Schulte leaks.
Because he was withholding them for a while, right?
Yes. And also, secondarily, this is also happening at the same time that Shadow Brokers is happening, and there is some weird sort of nebulous association between WikiLeaks people and the second source leaks that are also tied to shadow brokers at some certain points. So there's all of that that's happening in the background of the Schulte leaks. Now, in terms of, like, you know, like you said, the public interest, you know, the public, philosophically speaking, does not have a right to all information. That would be absurd because, you know, our own human ignorance.
No, look, I completely agree with you. But, I mean, are you saying that Schulte was perhaps, you know, a pawn in something bigger? Or is he just a nut job who didn't like his employer and wanted to inflict some harm? Like, what do we know about his thinking?
I think Schulte was a pawn in the sense that he's a sort of a radicalized individual who decided to sort of leak a bunch of, you know, the CIA arsenal, a cyber arsenal to WikiLeaks.
Yeah. And then you believe that, you know, that perhaps Assange was, you know, previewing that leak and sort of waving it around as in, like, maybe if I can get myself some immunity, this leak disappears. Is that sort of what you were getting at earlier?
Or affecting it on the part of we don't know the answer to that question. You know what I mean? Like, that's open tail end. And we don't know the answer.
I guess what you're getting at is in 2016, a whole bunch of really weird stuff started happening.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to just think critically through this. So look, the point is not to come to some certain judgment based on what we know in the public realm right now. It's that there's enough information in the public realm to raise red flags and for everyone to sort of caution and not just believe that everything that WikiLeaks says about itself is true, because it isn't.
Now,
right, it absolutely isn't.
Obviously, all of this has sort of inspired, I guess, you know, you're seeing, you know, it seems to be your position that they're doing it wrong, right? And you've started thinking, well, how would someone do this right? How should media organizations or, you know, even just, you know, NGOs, whoever, collections of people, how should they treat leaked material? And that is, you know, a topic that you're writing on in your master's. What, you know, where did you land on that? I mean, is it possible to construct guidelines that work for this type of thing? Say there's an email hack against, you know, we just saw reports that Burisma Holdings has been spearfished. Like, we don't really know if that was successful or how successful that was, despite the claims of the New York Times in that instance. But do we know, like, you know, are there guidelines for how a journalist should treat material like that if it surfaces and if it can be judged to be newsworthy?
I think what I'm proposing is, there, first of all, there already are guidelines. I mean, professional journalists, especially at Papers of Record, you know, they have a long history of sort of building consensus around what these things are, not printing unfounded rumors, you know, breaking the law in order to conduct journalism, whatever that might be. The landscape has changed. And so intelligence, information war, cyber operations, and journalism are now sort of operating in a much more confusing space. So what this thing I'm working on is really actually is looking at the topic from an intellectual point of view, impeaching the philosophy or the statements of organizations that are dealing with information and intelligence, defining what journalism is versus what intelligence is, separating them out, showing where they come together, and then also really using just war principles to define the sort of ethical constructs for intelligence, but then using a non-combatant ethical framework for journalism, because journalists aren't combatants. You know,
Under this framework, though, like the example I gave of, say, I get leaked a bunch of material from Burisma Holdings, you know, maybe I don't have the full context, but I'm leaked, you know, one person's mail spool and I'm going through it and there's stuff in there that might look bad for, say, Joe Biden and his family. Like, you know, how can I use these guidelines to guide my work, you know, in working with that sort of material?
Well, number one, I think one has to recognize that the public is not entitled to all information, right? We don't know everything as human beings. Like, we don't have this kind of Faustian, omniscient sort of, you know, knowledge. And so therefore, human knowledge is limited. And that limits also, you know, the fact of our right. It doesn't exist as a right in the moral right sense. Okay, so then there's, the journalist has a duty to reveal information that's in the public interest. And the public interest obviously can be defined in different ways by different people. I'm not saying that I have the, you know, some sensibility of what the public interest is and that everyone should follow my discussion. We have to understand what it means when we say something is in the public interest. Number one, you know, wrongdoing, crimes, blah, 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 blah. And people, I mean, even with my academic advisor, you know, we can argue even about the Pentagon Papers. You know, if somebody's in the military, they might say, well, the Pentagon Papers is da, 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 da. Other people might say, well, a war that kills, you know, X amount of American soldiers and Vietnamese people is actually a wrongdoing. So I'm not trying to get into specific examples like that, you know what I mean, and tell people what they should think. But we have to understand, what is a moral right? Where does it come from? Okay. So secondly, back to your particular question about, you know, Burisma and what's in the public right. Journalism has to be able to distinguish for itself what is in the public interest to know about Joe Biden. Are they being manipulated? Or, you know, how do they analyze a particular document or data set accurately or precisely enough? How do they avoid, you know, being manipulated by a foreign adversary? And then also, like, how do they minimize harms to the rights of other people under moral rights theory? Privacy, you know, a more proper one's reputation.
I think where it gets complicated for me, right, is that, like, you can always find newsworthy public interest stuff from a trove of information, right? So it really depends on whose information you've got access to. So you could, you know, be leaked a whole bunch of stuff from Burisma Holdings and, you know, you'd be sitting on that pumping out stories daily for a couple of months, right? That's probably what would happen. But on the other hand, you know, if you had information, say, from the other side, you know, political rivals of Biden, you could do the same thing. So it seems like by just making the material available, because everybody's got stuff they don't want reported, just by making the material available to journalists, you're sort of tilting the agenda. And that's why it's so powerful, right? Because it is legitimately newsworthy stuff, but it's just the bias is inherent in actually having access to the material. I mean, that's what happened in 2016. I'm sure if the RNC had its mail spool dumped, there would have been a pretty steady drumbeat of stories out of that as well. So, you know, I think the problem we got to deal with here is this asymmetry in source material. And that's the problem that, you know, I can't think of a way to get around that, because it's great to say journalists should, you know, think responsibly and, you know, maybe sit on stuff if they're being manipulated, but that's not how it's going to work, because the next guy from, you know, joeblowsblog.com is going to get he's going to write that stuff up and it's going to go viral on bloody Facebook. You know, it is a completely new world, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why I think media professionals need to be much more versed in what intelligence is, because an intelligence analyst or, you know, practitioner would be able to, like, articulate what they don't know, what they know they don't know. I mean, there are known unknowns, but, like, where they would actually say, okay, I actually only have access to this. So therefore, what, you know, how am I being manipulated by the lack of information? What is my adversary trying to, you know, cause me to conclude and have, like, some kind of critical thinking around that? So being trained as an analyst in that way would be useful for journalists. I think the other thing too that you raised, and I just want to sort of end on this, is it's not like we're completely in a new territory. You know, I think in the case of information war, we can learn a lot from journalists who have covered armed conflict that involves kinetic use of force, because in those environments, or even look at the Northern Ireland troubles.
You know, the first casualty in war is truth, right? And they're used to operating that in that environment. And yeah, I see where you're coming from with that, for sure.
Independence, impartiality, recognizing that they're, you know, subject to biases and, you know, increased level of manipulation by belligerents. They also, you know, people always talk about the problem with embedded reporting. I mean, if you don't have embedded reporting, though, you don't have reporting at all, because yeah, journalists need to be protected. So that, you know, there are drawbacks on just sort of looking at it that way. The other thing too is that during the Northern Ireland troubles, you know, on both sides of the divide, journalists reportedly were in the same union, and they practiced this kind of religious independence, and they became a trusted conduit for information. Mm. And that's really important in the midst of a confusing information environment, you know, in the new world that we live in. Journalists have to maintain a certain level of rigor to maintain public trust. And that's really critical to society. So back to that social role.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I found really fascinating about 2016 is I remember when the CrowdStrike report dropped. I even remember exactly where I was. I mean, it was middle of 2016. I was in Brazil. And, you know, as soon as I saw that, I mean, you know, we know CrowdStrike, we know their work. It was a good report. And we're like, holy crap, right? Like, this is going to get really interesting. And then the DNC stories started coming out. And the fact that Russia was behind this stuff was sort of secondary. Like, it's easy to forget that. But people didn't really give a shit about the Russian involvement side until after Trump won, because there was this sort of expectation that, like, no way was he going to win. So, you know, we're going to report on all this DNC stuff and it doesn't really matter. And I feel like, to a degree, a lot of the media that were reporting on that, who might not necessarily have been fans of Donald Trump, kind of went, oh crap, what have we done? And then the story became about Russia interference. And I sort of wonder, next time something like this happens, if it's going to change the nature of the coverage.
It's hard to know. I mean, I think it's really the response, like, you know, doctors and lawyers, which are also social professions, they tend to have, like, organizations that, you know, regulate themselves. Journalism is different than those things because it's not regulated by the government and it never should be.
Yeah, right. And well, I mean, the other thing that's happened post 2016 too is this hyper-partisan thing, which is just like, I mean, the US media was always pretty partisan, but now it is insane on both sides, right? It's like if you lean this way, you watch this network. If you lean that way, you watch that network. There doesn't seem to be anything left in the middle. So I just sort of wonder if, like, they're splitting off into different camps that are essentially going to be waging this information war, right? Like, it's just, what a time to be alive, 2020 AD.
Totally. And you raise a really, really important point about just, you know, any adversary who, you know, it could even be just a malicious actor, it doesn't have to be a nation state, can exploit that blockbuster leak, because that's where you join everyone together. You know, yeah, the Snowden leak, like a Hollywood film, you know, everybody's talking about it. Everybody's reporting on it. It's like, it gets everyone out of their silos and they're into it. Right. into that subject matter. So it's something that I think that journalists, you know, look, there's even differences between ethics and legality. Like pornographers can, you know, obviously publish nude pictures, right? They're protected under the First Amendment. Lots of things that are considered to be, you know, reprehensible to certain, you know, parts of society can be published. It's a question of journalism as a social profession, though, has a code. And so this particular thing I'm working on is for journalists. And I think that it's important that as a, you know, collective profession, that people talk about this stuff, because it's also about trust. Which sources of information do we trust as people, right? And to come to those sort of conclusions using our, you know, analysis and critical thinking. I don't have a prescription for, you know, the just society that's built on a, you know, ancient unicorn burial mound. Like, that's not my job in life. You know what I mean? I'm just a human being. But I do think that, you know, for me, that it's important, because I can do it, is to think through these issues deeply and to try to understand what the ideas are and whether or not they're valid or have any, you know, any real merit.
Well, Alexa O'Brien, it's been a real pleasure chatting to you about, I mean, God, what did we even talk about? It was, you know, WikiLeaks. It was the information environment, espionage, journalism. It's been a really fascinating chat, and I'll be keeping an eye out for your future work, you know, with a keen eye. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Alexa O'Brien there with a chat all about WikiLeaks. And yeah, interesting stuff. Big thanks to Alexa for her time, and big thanks to the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for making this edition of Risky Business possible. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.